On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we're going to talk a whole lot about free agency, Shohei Ohtani getting a surprise shoulder surgery, Gerrit Cole opts out, then says LOL JK Control Z, and of course, we will take a deep breath on a bizarre morning in America. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world for whom the words free and agency ring hollow on this Wednesday morning. I'm Jake Mintz, and that is Jordan Schusterman. Hey.
Hi, Jake.
Hey, Jordan.
Now, we knew we were going to be podcasting on this Wednesday morning. We told you so on Monday. But we'd be lying if we told you we didn't think it'd feel a little bit different. But that's okay. We are going to talk about free agency on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. But before we do, as we like to be as transparent about Jake and Jordan as we can, because that's the least we can do if you are donating your time and energy to listen to us on a regular basis, we just want to say a few things about how we're feeling before we talk about Roki Sasaki and, you know, whether Clay Holmes is good. So, Jake, take it away.
So, if you've been listening to us for, you know, any amount of time, you know we're not exactly flying high today. We are not political experts, and this is not a political podcast, thank God. But we did both grow up in D.C., so I guess maybe in some ways we are qualified. But, you know, in chatting about this dumb sport, we always try and give you people our truest selves, and it would be dishonest to open this show without acknowledging that, considering what happened in the election last night, that today for us personally is a big bummer. And I, you know, I don't want to get into the weeds on this, but I'm particularly thinking about my late grandmother, who started working for Planned Parenthood in the 1960s and dedicated a lot of her life fighting for reproductive rights. I'm thinking about my wife, who does that for a living, and all that Jordan and I can offer you on this 45 minutes, besides some, you know, empty optimistic platitudes, is a distraction, right? Baseball is intertwined with the good and the bad of American society, of humanity, yes. But at the same time, it is an avenue for removal from the, you know, scarier, realer things about our world. So on this episode, we're going to say some stuff about Jorge Soler getting traded to the Anaheim Angels. And at some point, we might act as if that is really important. It is unimportant by comparison. We know that. We are aware. When we're like, oh my God, it'll be a huge deal if Roki Sasaki comes over. Like, it'll be a huge deal within this sphere. We get that. But that's all we know how to do. To make some dumb jokes, analyze the sport, have you laugh a bit, teach you something, and fill 45 minutes of your day three times a week. And all I would advocate to people is be empathetic and amplify kindness and joy as much as you possibly can. Yeah. I could say 100,000 more things. Yes. I don't feel qualified to do so. And so I'm going to leave it at that.
Yes. And to your point, just echoing some of those sentiments, you know, debating whether Danny Jansen is actually, you know, worthy of being a starting catcher for the next 5 years for someone feels very trivial. It's also kind of exactly what I want to talk about right now. You know, that's kind of where I'm at, which is
there was another debate.
There will be more debates to come on this episode, I'm sure. But yeah, it's a difficult morning for a lot of reasons, but this is our job and we are lucky to have it. And we hope that this can serve as some amount of escape, at least momentarily, from a difficult time for, I know, a lot of the people listening. So, thank you for those words, Jake. And, yeah,
just quickly, you know, we got an email from someone kind of asking about how the election in America intertwines with baseball and the political layout of baseball. If you have thoughts about that, if you want to share them with us, like, email us, we'll respond in time. It is interesting. I certainly cannot unpack my thoughts about it this morning on my third cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And yeah. Certainly not my last.
So hopefully we can keep our facts straight on minimal sleep and emotional energy. But you know what, Jake? Free agency is bound to send us in some weird directions regardless. So we obviously have a good amount of news that has sort of piled up over the last week or so. We're going to try to get to a lot of it. But we are going to begin with someone who honestly, thankfully, is not a free agent again. It won't be anytime soon unless Andrew Friedman decides to leave. Remember that? Shohei Ohtani. This was before I logged off for the evening with very few intentions of logging back on. I saw a tweet from the World Series champion Los Angeles Dodgers. And that is going to be the first thing we talk about before we talk about any of the free agency or moves that have already been made. Because Tuesday evening, the Dodgers tweeted, Shohei Ohtani today underwent successful arthroscopic surgery performed in Los Angeles by Dr. Neil L. Atrosh to repair a labrum tear that resulted from a left shoulder dislocation October 26th. He is expected to be ready for spring training.
They should call him Dr. Neil L. Reattach.
They should call him Dr. In terms of, you know, just fame and, you know, name recognition, the Dodgers are putting Neil L. Atrosh. He has just been skyrocketing. And by the way, this is also an impressive moment here. I think we've spent so much time talking about Tommy John surgeries with the James Andrews of the world. And of course, you know, Keith Meister right down in Texas. But L. Atrosh kind of showing some versatility here, you know, repairing the labrum. We love to see this for Neil.
The Los Angeles Dodgers are putting the L. Atrosh family through college by their pitching development. Let's talk about Shohei Ohtani and how interesting this is. So when you mentioned that the world champion Los Angeles Dodgers tweeted this, and when you see their Twitter avatar picture, it says world champions on it. And to see that photo combined with our leadoff hitter had a labrum tear because he slid into second base weirdly, that really heightens just how outrageous it is. Now, look, did Shohei Ohtani light the world on fire in the World Series? No. Did he light the world on fire during the postseason? Not really. He had moments.
He had some big swings. There were, I mean, again, I know you didn't see it because you were looking down or in the bathroom. I can't remember. But, you know, the home run he hit Citi Field was one of the more memorable home runs of the postseason. Of course.
767 playoff OPS and 76 plate appearances is undeniably below Shohei Ohtani's
for sure
standard.
For sure.
That's a fact, right? Mm-hmm. Now, he only had a bum shoulder for some of that. He went 2-for-19 with two walks during the World Series. Like, mm-hmm. That's below his standard. A lot of that was because his shoulder was kind of banged up. Now we know that it makes sense that he's getting surgery. It's good that he's going to be okay for opening day. This doesn't change the way that I think about the Dodgers World Series or Shohei Ohtani. I am not surprised that he played through this. I think a lot of players would, given the stakes. If you can swing a bat, and you can shoot that shoulder up with numbing agents, they're going to do it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make it any less impressive, obviously, but like it is something I think a lot of players would try and play through.
Particularly because this is also probably important in terms of being concerned about it moving forward. I mean, my thought, we think we knew he was going to play through it. The fact that it's his back shoulder from, you know, how he swings, I'm curious if you have any thoughts about this, again, whether we are perfect, you know, biomechanical experts about how this would maybe impact his recovery as a pitcher. I know it's also, you know, his left shoulder, so that's good news for him as a right-handed pitcher. But that's at least another thing that will at least probably be talked about as he continues that rehab, which we are also anticipating he will be ready full go in spring training. So I think ultimately it is a a strange footnote that maybe will be lost to history, assuming he comes back okay, that this happened in this World Series that he won. But, you know, in the moment, that game too, it is what's a pretty wild way to tear your labrum with that. I mean, it was a non-contact slide. It was just him just like planting his arm on the ground. It's a very strange, strange play. You see plenty of guys, you know, planting their arm on the ground or at least dragging it when they slide like that. So again, hopefully this isn't impacting him. And it's nice that they just told us this is what he got. He will be ready for spring training. And we don't have to like wonder about this, because this was going to be a question, I have to imagine, at the GM meetings. I don't know if like Brandon Gomes or Andrew Friedman have spoken yet. The GM meetings are going on right now in Texas. I imagine that would have been one of the first questions, but it's nice that they're just like, this is what surgery he got, and we'll see him in spring training. So we don't really have to think about it any more than that.
Let's move on to Ohtani's countryman, Roky Sasaki. This is a very interesting character this winter. Who is Roky Sasaki? Jordan? Let's give people the very simple overview. Sasaki is, in some ways, like Japanese baseball Bryce Harper, but a pitcher. He has been very well known for a very long time. He has been outstanding in the NPB. He is, I believe, 23 years old.
Just turned 23 a couple days ago.
Which means that if he were to come over now, he would be subject to international bonus pool stuff, and there's a very significant limit on what he can make. And he throws really hard. His stuff was a little bit down this year. And if he came over, he would be the third best player available in free agency, behind Corbin Burns and Juan Soto. Yeah. Like, that's where we would have him on our list, I think.
Yeah, we haven't totally fleshed that out, and we're going to get to our actual free agent list later. But yeah, I mean, to your point, he is the epitome of a pitching phenom, more than really anything that we've had in the U.S. because, yes, Skeens fit that description once he got to LSU and was, you know, 21, right? But Sasaki has been this since he was like 15 and dominating high school ball and throwing harder than any pitcher had ever been seen in Japan. And then dominating in MPB as soon as he got there and showing up in the WBC, you know, as a 21-year-old and averaging 100 miles an hour on his fastball. He just checks all of those boxes of just pitching phenom. But to your point, the reason why he is a bit of a mystery character this offseason is because it is not a guarantee that he is going to come over. Here's what we do know. He wants to pitch in MLB. Okay, now that might be obvious to anybody, but that hasn't always been the case, right? This has become more common for players at the top level in the leagues in Asia who are like, hell yeah, I want to go over and be in the big leagues because that's the cool thing to do right now, and I want to challenge myself. And that's why we've had even more. We've seen the likes of Yoshida, Ha-Sung Kim, of course, coming over from the KBO. Sasaki has made it very clear from the beginning. However, because he has only played four seasons in NPB, he would need to be posted by his team, and that is entirely at his team's discretion for at least several more seasons. He asked to be posted last year, and as expected, they said no. He is understandably asking again to be posted this year. And at the time of this recording, while there has been some reporting that it is more likely that we are heading towards him being posted, right now, a lot of the people who are following Japanese baseball closely are still saying there's really no reason for them to let him go at this point. So while it is possible that he is going to end up being a free agent, and if that is the case, it will be extremely important and unique in the sense that he will be subject to international bonus pool money, which means, like when Ohtani came over, it is not just going to be, oh, well, only the Mets and Dodgers can sign him because they're the only ones that can offer him the most money. Anyone is going to be able to afford him. It will essentially be his choice to pick the team that he wants to play for. But as it stands right now, I just don't know why they would let him go other than, you know, it's easy for us to be like, well, of course, it's the right thing to do. He wants to play in MLB. Let him do that. Like, that dynamic is just not in play here. And so I know we all want to see Roky in MLB as soon as possible, but it's just, it's not that simple in this case. So maybe in a few weeks we are talking about him being posted, and it will be next to Soto, you know, the biggest free agent of the offseason for sure. But right now, we're not at that stage yet, but we definitely wanted to acknowledge it.
And the reason that it's slightly different than Ohtani is when Ohtani was coming up, like when he signed with the fighters, part of the conversation there was, when I'm ready, I expect you to let me go. And Ohtani used that leverage to allow the fighters to have him, basically, right? Like, that was him agreeing to play in NPB and not making the jump out of high school to the States was contingent in part on that understanding. I don't know if that's the case with Sasaki, and I would imagine that it's not, right? Because very rarely, if ever, is a player like Ohtani legitimately threatening to skip NPB altogether and go right to the big leagues.
Yeah, and my understanding too is each of the teams in NPB historically handle these situations differently. Some are a lot more hardline and some are a lot more likely to just be like, yeah, like, we'll take the posting fee and we'll move on. But obviously, if you're, you know, Chivalote, like, you you have this guy, like, and he contractually, there's no reason for you to let him go. Like, you can understand them being pretty reluctant to let him go. So we'll see. Again, this is clearly still a developing story. It definitely, I know, you know, our friend Kyle McDaniel wrote that signs were indicating pointing him towards and that the Dodgers would be favorites. I understand that that got a lot of attention yesterday, and maybe that is ends up being the case. But from where we sit right now, that is where we kind of see the Sasaki situation. There's a long winter ahead of us. This will get resolved in one way, and then we will know if we actually are going to talk about it more.
News segment alert.
Explain this to me like I'm five.
Everybody, welcome to Explain This to Me Like I'm Five. Baseball can be a confusing endeavor. Jordan Schusterman's IQ is higher than mine, and so I'm going to ask him to explain this to me like I'm five. Jordan, what is going on with Gerrit Cole and the New York Yankees?
I mean, I'm going to do my best here, but based on where we left off our conversation on Monday, I think this outcome was somehow not one that we were considering. So let's rewind 48 hours. When we spoke on Monday, we described the situation where Gerrit Cole had a clause in his contract where he
could... What does clause mean? I'm five.
Clause has a detail...
Santa Claus?
not quite. If this, then that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Remember, I'm five.
It's an important detail that must be followed, a rule within the contract.
Rule.
Okay.
Rule, I get. Yeah.
That allowed Gerrit Cole, he could say, there's 4 years and $144 million remaining on my contract. I am going to opt out of that. Now, I know you're five. It's like, why would you say no? Why would you not do that?
Because, as far as I know, $10 is a lot of money.
Or $144, let alone $144 million, right? He decided to opt out. However, the rule also stated that the Yankees were able to override that to say that actually this rule is more strong. They said, we would like to keep you, Gerrit Cole, for 5 years and $180 million.
So then when Gerrit Cole opted out, mm-hmm. the Yankees just picked up that last year on the contract, right?
It sure seemed that Gerrit Cole deciding to use his rule in the contract, was a version to get the Yankees to use their rule as part of the contract, which when we spoke on Monday, we assumed that was going to be the case. However, it appears that the Yankees had more control in this situation than perhaps we realized. Because when the deadline arrived on Monday evening and we had to learn whether the Yankees were indeed activating that fifth year and choosing to keep him at 5 years and $180 million, as was their right according to that rule in the contract, the news was actually he's just going to stay on the contract. He was always going to be. It's as if he never opted out. And this is very strange because that brought up the concept or the premise that he actually never opted out in the first place. Because that is the only way we end up back at this outcome, which is that Gerrit Cole will remain with the Yankees for 4 years and $144 million, or so we think. Basically, it seems that Gerrit Cole, After doing this, even though we all knew there was no secret, Gerrit Cole wanted to remain a Yankee, the Yankees, and Brian Cashman spoke about this, said, this is really fast to be trying to figure out if we definitely want to keep you for this fifth year. So you're not actually going to leave, right? And Gerrit Cole apparently was like, yeah, no, you're right. So I guess I'd never opted out in the first place.
There's a lot, and I might be six now.
Again, but I'm
my understanding,
too.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you, as my parents said, Jake, you only get dessert if you eat your broccoli. And I said, I'm not eating my broccoli. And then you said, fine, no dessert. And then I sat there for 3 minutes and then I ate my broccoli.
Yes. Yep.
Is that kind of what happened here?
I think so. It was like, oh, okay. But like you do want dessert. Like yeah. there, you're not going to suddenly not want dessert.
Right.
And so you're going to accept that to get the dessert, you're going to have to do the thing, even though you thought you were going to be able to not have broccoli and get dessert.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to eat the broccoli and then you will still get dessert, which is what you wanted. And Ultimately, the broccoli, like you can deal with that.
We got a text from a player yesterday, Jordan, who said, what is going on here? Yeah. And it is bizarre and confusing because this has just never happened. But at the same time, pitchers don't make this kind of money ever before at all. And so the stakes of everything involving Gerrit Cole and the Yankees are bigger and understandably need more time to work themselves out. My takeaway here, though, I have two as a five-year-old. One is that Gerrit Cole, Yankees today, tomorrow, forever. He wants to be in the Yankees. The Yankees want him to be in the Yankees. His decision to, I guess, opt out was not based on a desire to leave the Yankees. It was on a desire to extract more money from the Yankees, which is understandable. His agent is Scott Boras. Gerrit Cole, he likes money. He wanted more. That's fine. However, and this is my second takeaway as a five-year-old, Gerrit Cole had less power, less leverage here than he thought he did. Where the Yankees' unwillingness to simply pick up that last year just shows that they're not going to, they're like, no, we don't want to do that. We know how much you want to be here. We're going to work out a deal, and that's fine. At the end of the day, this doesn't really have a whole lot of impact on the 2025 Yankees or the 2026 Yankees. I think it just shows us how much Gerrit Cole wants to be around and shows us that sometimes Scott Boras maybe overplays his hand a little bit.
I can imagine there's still a world where they work out some sort of extension that changes the pay, you know, the exact year-to-year AAV and maybe makes it longer than 4 years. Although, again, there's no reason for the Yankees to do that other than, I guess, keep Gerrit Cole happy. But 4 years is a long time for a pitcher that they have him guaranteed for. So, and if we understand that that is the nature that the contract still stands at, then like, that's fine. But yeah, this is everything you said was right. And extract is an impressive vocab word for a five-year-old. So
thank
nice
you.
Work.
Look, kids these days, Gen Alpha, Skibidi, Ohio, toilet. Like my dude, Gerrit Cole was just mashing Control Z on his BlackBerry the second the Yankees were like, LOL, no.
I will say this is a amusing first course to a winter of Scott Boras. This is a very funny, we are going to be talking about Boras so much this winter, and this is a very funny first move for him.
I would like to initiate the Scott Boras winter scoreboard. We're going to oversimplify this. Did he win? Did he lose? Did he draw? I would say Scott Boras starts the winter 0-1. This is an L for Scott Boras. He is down a goal on the road, and he has many more opportunities to come. Jordan, let's take a break. And when we get back, we will put our full attention and love into free agency. We have a list of the top 50 free agents in our opinion, and we are going to fly through that and give you our thoughts on a whole lot of play. Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, George Schusterman. MLB free agency has actually begun. If Juan Soto wanted to sign with the Reds right now, I believe he could do that. Yeah. He would just deny the qualifying offer and get a house in Florence, Kentucky, and spend the next 13 years hitting a lot of home runs at Great American Ballpark, but that is unlikely. So with free agency underway, here's what we're going to do. Here's our little intro to this madness. We have a top 50 list. I'm going to fly through that list from 50 to 1. I'm going to say a sentence on each player. Jordan might say a sentence on each player. We'll probably say more sentences on Juan Soto because duh. At any point during the list, either of us can slam a button, pause the conversation, and add a couple more thoughts on a player. Jordan, you have 5 buttons to press. Think of them as emojis.
5 or 4
buttons to press. 4.
Thank you.
Think of them as emojis. You have the gritted teeth yikes emoji that you could press when there's a dude you're scared about. Shrug emoji. Guy you have no idea what to do with. Sleep emoji. Not player people are sleeping on. Player who is going to be sleeping deep into the winter and will be the last to sign. And then snort emoji, which is my favorite personally, is the dude that you're high on. Do you understand the rules of this bit?
I believe I do. I'm ready to roll. Let's start counting down. You can, by the way, follow along this list, which is updated with blurbs for most of the players by this point. We've been adding those throughout the week. You can check it out on the Yahoo Sports MLB page, our top 50 list. But let's begin at 50, Jake. A player that we were not expecting to be on this list, but he is on this list. It is Travis d'Arnaud. The Braves declined an $8 million club option, likely because they already paid Sean Murphy a bunch of money and their top prospect is a catcher, Drake Baldwin. That's all I have to say about Travis d'Arnaud, but I know you've thought about him a lot.
I love Travis d'Arnaud. I think he is in the small circle of clubhouse guys who make a legitimate positive impact, and he is absolutely beloved around baseball. He was a league average hitter as a 35-year-old catcher this past year. I am surprised that the Braves did not bring him back. I think there's still a chance they rework something to bring him back. However, if I was a team like the Orioles, I would pay $8 million for Travis d'Arnaud to be my backup in an instant. I think that he is still pretty good. Even if he is like an 80 OPS plus guy, he's a average framer who has all the soft skills you want as a catcher. I would advocate for him higher than 50 on this list, but I'm a Travis d'Arnaud stan. At 49, Frankie Montas, who started on opening day on the mound for the Cincinnati Reds. They were hailing him as like the leader of this staff. He was meh for them. Ends up getting traded to the Brewers at the deadline, made a couple tweaks, and now looks like he's never going to have the upside he had over in Oakland. But this is someone who could make an impact in a rotation.
People will still be talking themselves into Frankie Montas. I don't count myself as one of them, but I do know that he definitely impressed me as someone that like everybody loved in Cincinnati, which I was surprised that was a reputation he garnered so quickly. Is that going to make his ERA go lower? No. But he still throws a nasty splitter and he's something. And he stayed healthy, which is important, right? After coming off the shoulder surgery, he was healthy for a whole season. But he's down here for a reason. We can't put him much higher than this.
That is true. At 48, Kenley Jansen. You know about Kenley Jansen. You can't talk about Kenley Jansen without talking about Craig Kimbrell and Aroldis Chapman, the three closers of a generation. Both of those two guys are also free agents. Neither of those guys are on our list. I think that at this point in their careers, as they rage against the dying of the light, Jansen is the most valuable of this trio, then probably Chapman and then Kimbrell. Ugh. He is not dominant anymore, the king of cutters. However, he's still like a good reliever. Over the last 3 seasons, only Clase and Josh Hader have more saves. Now, I know that's a weird stat to use here, but it just shows that people still trust this guy in the ninth inning. And I would not be surprised for a team to sign him. He has been public about wanting to go back to the Dodgers. If the Dodgers want him is a different question entirely. At number 47, Andrew Heaney.
Heen Dog Bump Day will continue somewhere. Remember when he was amazing for the Dodgers in 2022? That was indeed just a blip. Now he is a very boring back of the rotation lefty starter. But because he is left-handed, he will continue to be getting employed probably for a few more seasons. So definitely nothing exciting here, but he will keep getting jobs. He is fine.
At number 46, Jesse Winker, who looked cooked after a handful of mediocre seasons. He was an all-star in 2021. Signs on a one-year pillow contract with the Nationals and is great. Gets traded to the Mets at the deadline. Slams his helmet. Is endearingly grimy. Gets into a shouting match with Willy Adames during the wildcard round. Very much a character in our world. I like Jesse Winker quite a bit. He still crushes right-handed pitching. He's not a great defensive outfielder. If you're a team who needs a bat, just a bat, he can fill that role for you. Speaking of guys who are just a bat, at number 45, Josh Bell.
Josh Bell was outstanding for Arizona. Really saved their ass when Christian Walker was hurt. And again, really lucky sequence when Christian Walker got hurt like the day before the deadline. So they were able to trade for Josh Bell, and he was fantastic. This is one of the streakiest hitters we have in baseball. When he's going good, he is a force of nature. When he's going bad, it looks really bad. So we have him down at the bottom here because he's still not that old, and he probably still has some above average offensive performance in him, which is something that in an era where offense is hard to come by, he will still also be getting jobs.
At number 44, Jorge Polanco, who the Mariners had an option on, but they let him walk.
$12 million team option, which when they acquired him looked like, ooh, that could be a good deal to keep Polanco in the Pacific Northwest for multiple seasons. Nope. His left knee was injured for apparently the whole season. He just had surgery on it. He is using that as at least part of a reason why he was very bad, which is fair. But yeah, I mean, he was obviously a disappointing acquisition for Seattle. He's still only 31. He does have a lengthy track record of being injured. So this latest knee surgery doesn't exactly inspire confidence from that standpoint. But he was just a good hitter, a good for basically four or five straight years before this past year. And as we just saw with Teoscar, I think a lot of teams will be like, all right, great, get healthy, get out of Seattle, and you'll just go back to being a near all-star level second baseman again. So he might end up looking way too low on this list if he is indeed healthy and ends up in a better ballpark.
Next up on the list at number 43, Tomoyuki Sugano. Not a name that people have maybe heard before. Jordan, give people an overview.
This is a Japanese right-handed pitcher who originally was planning to come over a few years ago. However, when he was posted, this is when he was still part of the posting system. Ultimately, he just didn't end up working out a deal with a major league team. And so he went back and pitched a few more seasons in Japan. Now he's 35. He has continued to put up very good numbers. He throws like six different pitches, doesn't throw very hard. But what he does is he gets a lot of balls on the ground. And in NPB, where the ball is a lot less lively, it is a lot easier to pitch to contact, pound the zone, and you usually aren't going to get beat. This is one of the most accomplished pitchers in Japan. And now he is making the leap here, not under the posting system. So he will be a full free agent. All the expectations are he will be coming over as a regular free agent. However, because he's 35 and because he only throws 92 or so, there's probably a limit to how much teams are going to be willing to commit to him. But I could see him getting a pretty lucrative one-year deal.
At number 42 and 41, we're going to group these two together. The old folks home pitchers, Justin Verlander and Max Scherzer. Putting Verlander at 42nd on our list is funny because he is 42. That should not be lost. Even if Justin Verlander gets cranked this year and sucks, it is still unbelievable that he throws a pitch in the major leagues at 42, which he undoubtedly will. Time seemed to begin chipping away at this unbelievable duo, and perhaps that is understating it. Verlander missed a significant amount of time with the Astros, came back, and when he returned, was just straight up ass. His ERA this year was 5.48 in 90 innings. I saw him live, I believe, in August and just did not look good. I never want to doubt Justin Verlander. However, now is probably the time to start doing it.
It is interesting. I was there in Cleveland for his last start, and he actually looked pretty good. That was one of his better starts of the season. And he, you know, talking, just realizing, like, I remember before that, I was like, am I about to watch the last start of Justin Verlander's career? And it doesn't seem like that's going to be the case. However, it does seem likely it was the last start of his Astros career, which is significant. And who he chooses to latch on with next will be absolutely fascinating. And the same could be said about Scherzer.
So you say best start of a season. Yes, I agree with you. 7 hits, 3 runs, 5 Ks across 6 innings. To say that's the best start of Justin Verlander's stretch, like that's... would be the worst start, right? Yeah. Scherzer is a little different. He was just more hurt. Like, I understand Verlander was maybe pitching through discomfort, but I think being 42 years old is discomfort. Not that I can speak from experience. Scherzer is more just like, is this guy healthy? And when he's healthy, is he good enough to make signing him worth it? Both of these dudes will end up on teams and will throw innings for contenders next season. Like, I do not doubt that at all. It's more just, what are they giving you at this point in their careers? Pick one.
Who do I want next year?
Yeah.
I think Verlander, which sounds wild. Will you say they're going to be pitching for contenders? Obviously, that's what they're going to want. I'm not that sure they're going to end up on like one of the three best teams in baseball the way that we just have assumed recently. So who that ends up being, I think I'm going to go Verlander. I don't know. Like, part of me just feels like he was still dealing with things. Whereas, like, Scherzer's injury stuff at this point is so unpredictable and terrifying that I just feel like he is just going to wake up and realize he can't pitch anymore. In a way that Verlander, I think, physically is still ready to keep going. So I'm going to lean Verlander slightly, but I obviously don't feel great about it.
Next on our list, let's group this trio together. 40, 39, and 38. The old first baseman. Mm. Justin Turner, yes. Carlos Santana, and Paul Goldschmidt.
This is a fascinating group. Santana winning a gold glove, Paul Goldschmidt's tenure ending in St. Louis in kind of sad fashion, and then Justin Turner latching on and playing really well for Seattle after being traded there after the deadline. They all kind of bring something a little bit different, right? Santana is, they all have very strong clubhouse reputations in slightly different ways. They all are going to give you a good at bat. Goldschmidt, of course, has the elite performance in the most recent past, but seems to be trending in the wrong way a lot faster. Whereas Turner and Santana, okay. Yeah.
Goldschmidt won the 2022 NL MVP.
Yes. Right. And so, whereas Santana and Turner have basically just been holding the line for a really long time as just like average hitters, which is very impressive. Can Goldschmidt do that, or is he just going to be heading in the Jose Abreu track of, oh, this is unsalvageable? That's kind of what we're wondering here. We have Goldschmidt ranked at the top here because we perceive there to be more upside. But this is a really, really tough group to figure out, you know, and we're going to get to the big first baseman later with Pete and Christian Walker. But these ones are going to be very cheap alternatives who could end up being very productive. It's just hard to know what you're getting.
I'm so in on Carlos Santana. It's unhealthy. I'm not going to use my emoji here.
For signs the latest, because that's what I was going to say. Because I feel like these guys are going to be stuck behind Walker and Alonso. I think Goldschmidt is going to be waiting for a while.
You going to use it? Use
but,
it.
I also think he could just sign with the Astros tomorrow. So no, I'm saving it.
Okay. Sounds good to me. I love Carlos Santana. I just think he's great. At 37 and 36, grouped together, Kirby Yates and Blake Treinen. A pair of relievers. They are 38 and 37. However, they were just two of the best relievers in baseball. On Trinan, if you watched the World Series, I don't need to explain to you that he's still really good. Maybe he's bad now after that performance where he threw 2 1/3. No one threw more pitches on the Dodgers in Game 5 against the Yankees, which is wild. Kirby Yates had an unreal bounce back season in which he was an all-star for the Texas Rangers. But again, relievers are volatile and even more volatile when they are reaching this point in their careers. So let's keep the list moving. At 35 and 34, left-handed starters in their mid-30s, Matt Boyd at 34 and Jose Quintana at 35.
So we saw both of these guys pitching in the postseason in surprising fashion. And Boyd, of course, signing the middle of the year and really saving Cleveland's rotation to the degree that he could. Now, obviously, they still ended up a little bit short at the end of the season. But he set himself up nicely. And let's just remind everybody that Matthew Boyd, as far as I know, is also a Scott Boras client and received a very hefty contract a few years ago when I think we didn't necessarily expect him to. So I'm very curious to see if he's able to land a multi-year deal. Whereas Quintana, I think, is more of a known quantity. I don't know if there's as much perceived upside with Quintana, whereas Boyd, you know, that lack of sample size is maybe a good thing for him. You think that you could get more out of Boyd. But both of these guys, like we said about Heaney, except with even higher level of performance, I think both of these guys are definitely, you know, in position to land rotation jobs again.
At number 33 is Max Kepler, and I'm going to slam my shrug emoji button with this one.
He was in my mix for this 100%.
I have absolutely no idea what to make of Max Kepler. In 2023, he was outstanding. In 130 games, he was a well above average hitter, had a 20 OPS plus and 816 OPS. He hit 24 home runs. And it was like, wow, Max Kepler might get paid. He is still only going to be 32 years old, German born. And now it's like, I don't know, because he had a hip issue and a knee issue this season. He only ends up playing in 105 games and he's a below average hitter the entire time. If he's healthy, is he good? I guess he's a career 102 OPS plus guy. I have absolutely no idea what to make of Max Kepler. I would not touch him with a 10-foot pole. He scares me a little bit, but I am just confused more than anything else.
Well, I was going to say, because I was going to slam my who I'm scared about. Like and not because I think he's definitely bad, but because I am just like can totally imagine being tempted by it. Because of how good he looked also not that long ago when he was healthy. So I can imagine falling for that. I've been a big Kepler fan in the past, but I am not sure. This next guy, though, we have got another run of corner outfielders here that we can go in here next. Alex Verdugo, 32, Michael Conforto, 31, and Randall Grichuk at 30. Verdugo, you just watched a whole season of Verdugo in the Bronx. We obviously watched him strike out to end the World Series. And as you noted in your blurb here, just had one of the worst offensive seasons by a left fielder in baseball history. And we watched it the whole time, and we definitely knew it wasn't having a good season, but I'm not sure we understood how bad of a season it was.
Since integration in 1947, there have been 386 seasons in which a left fielder has had over 600 plate appearances. So that is like a everyday starter in left field, basically. No injuries, full season. By OPS, Alex Verdugo was second to last on that list. It is the second worst offensive season ever produced by an everyday left fielder since Jackie Robinson integrated baseball. Okay. And still, I am talking myself into the upside of Alex Verdugo. Now, he does a lot of things well. He never strikes out. He makes a lot of contact. He doesn't chase. He plays a great corner outfield. Problem is, when he makes contact with the baseball, it's like a pool noodle hitting a watermelon. Like, it doesn't go anywhere. I would not give him multiple years. There are a lot of free agent top 50 lists that don't have Verdugo on there at all. He is only 29 for next year. I still think there's an everyday average baseball player here, though.
But this is what is so perplexing about his season. He was average for 5 years in a row, right? 2020, you know, the line gets inflated a little bit in a smaller sample. But while we were not excited about his profile, 107 OPS plus in 21, 102 in 22, 123. Obviously, Boston was a little bit more of a favorable hitter's environment, but how did it fall off that badly in New York? Like, I still don't totally understand that. And because it's not like he was striking out more, but his contact was just awful. Like, he just could not hit the ball hard at all. And it was often on the ground. I just, it's, that's what's so weird. I am also probably not touching this one, but he is very perplexing. Anyway, Michael Conforto and Randall Grichuk are also here. Conforto had a very forgettable season. Not a bad season with the Giants, but very forgettable. Whereas Grichuk was sneaky, incredible. Now, Grichuk was very much in a platoon role with Arizona, but he was like a kind of a big reason why Arizona had one of the best offenses in baseball. Randall Grichuk was a big part of that. And he's, again, a little bit older here, too. You know, he's going to be 33 next year. But you kind of know what you're getting with Grichuk in a very real way. And if you have that elite skill of crushing lefties the way that he seemingly does, I think he's going to be in good position here. But I also feel like Conforto might be being slept on. I feel like Conforto, we get him out of San Francisco, we might be able to unlock something a little bit closer to his all-star past.
Are you slamming your dude you're high on emoji for Michael Conforto,
no,
Jordan?
No, definitely not. Not even close.
Okay. Great. And then Grichuk, yeah, like Grichuk was sneaky great for the Diamondbacks. And when a lineup like the Diamondbacks is that good, it's because players that aren't playing every day like Grichuk are having incredible seasons. I think he, a good team is going to pick this guy up, and he will have important October at-bats next season. At number 29, Danny Jansen, who we thought was going to be the only catcher before Travis d'Arnaud got on the list. Jansen, of course, played for two teams in the same game. It was whimsical. All your relatives asked you about it. We poo-pooed it, and people were like, why don't you like this more? At the end of the day, Danny Jansen is just a catcher. He's just an average catcher. He's not elite. He's not awful. If he's your everyday guy, you're not content with that, but you're also not concerned with that. He has shown up more offensive upside in the past. My biggest issue with him is that he just hasn't been able to stay healthy. Fascinated to see where he ends up. Catchers are a singular breed. At number 27 and number 28, Carlos Estevez at 27, Clay Holmes at 28. Holmes, obviously, longtime closer for the Yankees, just elite for a number of seasons. Backed up this year, gives up a lot of contact, a lot of it on the ground. Every Yankees fan wants to TP his house.
I'm sorry. If Clay Holmes is the longtime closer with the Yankees, what is Mariano Rivera?
Eternal.
Okay. Hasn't been there that long. But also did not finish the year as Yankees tenure as the closer, as we know.
Yeah, I watched his job. I saw that.
To Luke Weaver here. But I also think Clay Holmes is pretty good. I am way more in on Holmes than on Estevez. I will just put that flat out there, because I think the best version of Holmes is like pretty dominant, and whereas Estevez, it could go kind of in a hurry. Let's do one more and then let's take a break, Jake, to the top half. Jock Peterson, another one who part of that with Randall Grichuk, you know, part of the, oh wait, the Diamondbacks have scored the most runs in baseball. Every time they would flash the Yankees-Dodgers stats, second, third, run scored. And you're like, what, someone was ahead of these teams? Yeah, it was the Snakes. And they didn't make the postseason. Sad. Anyway, Jock Peterson is 33. He was outstanding. Of course, he is barely hitting against lefties. But my gosh, is he good when he hits against righties. He is he's a DH now. There's really no... I remember in spring training last year, he was like, I'm going to start running again. I'm working on my outfield defense. And then I believe literally played zero innings in the outfield, or at least I think, right? So that's pretty hilarious and very on brand for Jock. But this dude mashes. And again, if you're trying to get kind of instant offense, not too many other guys you can rely on as much as Jock Peterson here.
I'm going to slam my signs last button for Jock. Because he kind of has to wait for the first baseman to go off the board, because the first baseman and DHs are so intertwined. And I just think that whatever team ends up with Jock, he will not be the first option on their list. And so there is going to be something of a trickle down effect. Like, if you go look, by the way, at OPS for free agents, he's second behind Soto. Like, he banged this year. He was the best offensive production of his career. He doesn't face lefties, whatever. I think that's going to create a trickle-down effect for Jock, where it might be late February and he's still a free agent. So I'm going to slam that for him. Jordan, before we take a break, you have not used any of your four buttons.
I was going to use it and you flew, but it's fine. I got some other candidates. It's okay.
Okay.
We're good.
Great.
We're good. I'm hitting one right out of the break here. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, the top 25 free agents on our list. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, George Schusterman. Free agents roll on. Nick Pivetta at number 25.
I am going to slam my guy I am high on here.
Ooh.
That kind of just hit me. And I have it in the blurb here. 112 pitchers with 200 innings pitched the last 2 years. Nick Pivetta's 30% strikeout rate is fifth in baseball, behind only Glasnow, Snell, Sale, and Scooble. And we just don't talk about him at all. His issue is he gives up home runs. There's a lot of hard contact in the air, and that is scary. But if we can get him in a slightly better ballpark, and let's just find one more pitch that he can maybe use. Like, he clearly has, he's got a bunch of pitches. He's like, Boston has not max. That's the thing. Boston has helped him get to a really good place, but he's been really durable. And starters that can pile up strikeouts like this, there's just not that many of them. And it's a pretty large sample here. So I just really like what, when you combine the durability and the strikeouts compared to some of the other starters that we have ranked ahead of him, I just think that the value here is going to be significant. Now, the fact that he got a qualifying offer, I think speaks to how highly Boston thinks of him. And the fact that I think that kind of validates me being high on them, because I know a lot of Red Sox fans were like, why are we QOing him and not Tyler O'Neill? You know, more on him in a second. I don't know. I'm in on Pivetta. I think he's going to be in that, you know, 2-3 year range, and he could end up looking, you know, Seth Lugo-ish potentially at this time next year. So I'm going in, all in on Pivetta.
There's also a path where he does the Manaea contract. That's like 2 years, $16 million per with an opt in the middle.
Yeah.
And he just shoves and then opts and he's back on the market again next season.
Right. Or he just takes the QO and just does that in some version. Yeah.
At 24, Jeff Hoffman, fascinating player. 9th overall pick by the Rockies, which is never good if you're a pitcher. That's it, right? If I told you this guy was taken 9th overall as a college pitcher by the Rockies, you'd say, well, that's a bummer. Didn't work out. That's what happened with Hoffman. He got lost in the muck. But then he reemerges as a reliever, figures some things out with the Reds in 2022, shows up with Philly in 2023. And since then, he has just... he's been the fourth most valuable reliever in baseball. Like, he's just one of the best relievers now. Now, that could change at any instant. The only thing we know about the bullpen is that we don't know anything about the bullpen. He wants to go back to Philly. I think his market's going to be too robust for them, and he is going to end up closing for somebody. If the Angels hadn't just traded Carlos Estevez to the Phillies, I think the Angels would just sign Hoffman, if that makes sense.
I mean, they did just sign Robert Stevenson, and he immediately blew out and didn't throw a pitch for them. So I could see them trying to pay for another reliever. We will see. Hoffman feels he was really good. I know. He feels high just looking at this. But Hoff Daddy, respect, as someone who... one of our favorite early Futures Game memories is Jeff Hoffman dunking on Jake with a mini basketball hoop. Lost to history because Vine is dead. Let's move on to 23. Shane Bieber. This is another one that could end up looking very low. Shane Bieber, who had Tommy John in April of last season and will not be ready before opening day, we don't think. And might decide to just stay with Cleveland. Although, man, I think some team's just going to offer him some huge, you know, 2-year deal situation where maybe he can opt out potentially. He looked so good to start the season. I mean, it was like the best version of Bieber we had seen since 2020. And then it was gone in a blink. He's only 30. I just feel like someone is going to go, whether it is, you know, a Dodgers or like, I just think one of the big market teams is just going to throw a huge offer at him. By the way, like, this is what the Angels should do, if we're being real. Like, they should be overwhelming him if they want to pretend to be competitive. I just feel like there's more upside here that you might be getting for a discount than basically any other pitcher you're going to be getting here. So, of course, there's risk, but this is one where you're betting on modern medicine and hoping that he can come back and look like a legitimate frontline guy.
At number 22, Walker Buehler. We've talked a ton about Buehler, obviously, main character in the World Series win. He was really amazing in his last three outings, two great starts, and that unforgettable relief appearance, but straight up wasn't good over the course of the season. Fascinated to see where he lands, whether it's with the Dodgers or somewhere else. Can he recapture the consistency that made him one of the best pitchers in baseball for a four-year period? We'll see. When you get this far away from that many surgeries and we haven't seen change yet, I'm concerned. I would be interested to give him a trial run next year. He clearly had the bulk in the end. He was making those starts. It's just a matter of where the quality's at. We saw it. It's still in there. It's just a matter of whether his body can do it consistently over time. At number 21, the top reliever on our list, Tanner Scott. Best reliever available. Relievers are weird. He's the best one. Traded from Miami to San Diego at the deadline. He doesn't give up any hard contact. He's the best in baseball at that. Limiting hard contact. Walks a ton of guys, but also strikes out a ton of guys. He throws with the correct hand, which is his left one. He's allowed 6 home runs since the start of 2023. I like Tanner Scott. I just am fascinated to see who's going to really break the bank for this kind of reliever.
Yeah. Relievers are so volatile that, is he absolutely going to be better than Cleveland Clay Holmes next year? I don't know. I agree with him being ranked as the best reliever for sure. I think he's earned that. But all relievers are terrifying. So I could put him in here as dude I'm scared about. You know what? I am going to do that. I am going to say he is, because any reliever that we get excited about, and if he actually ends up getting a 4-year deal, I just think, as often is the case, that can sometimes look so bad so fast. So even though I think he's pretty good, if he ends up getting a legitimate $50 million plus, that is going to be scary. So I will maintain my concern for reliever volatility, and I will put him as the dude I am scared about, even though I do think Tanner Scott is good.
Speaking about dudes that I'm scared about, I'm pressing my button for the next guy, which is number 20, Tyler O'Neill. For me, it is simple. Baseball players don't look like this. They don't. They don't look like a shaker bottle and a protein powder, and that they just don't look that muscular. And I am legitimately concerned about how his body is going to age into his 30s. He had a horrible strikeout rate, striking out 33% of the time. His defense is not that good anymore. I understand that he bangs, but he doesn't. I just, no thanks.
Well,
man.
He's
wishing nothing but the best.
I'm pressing the I don't know what to make of him, because you can't deny that the ceiling when Tyler O'Neill is cooking is outrageous. And it's weird because I don't know, he's been much slower. I'm not really sure where the speed went. Maybe that is just a matter of and to your point, that's a bit of the scared thing. So you could put this in scared. I get that. I'm going with I have no idea what to do with him, just because he's basically just alternated. The season he just had was very similar to his original breakout year in 2021, except without the Gold Glove defense. But I'm not totally convinced that the good outfield defense is totally gone, but the health is certainly a concern. But he is a force. When he's cooking, that is a legitimately impactful bat that very few hitters on this list can say that they are. So I'm going to keep him in that I don't know what to do with. I'm kind of leaning in your direction of I would be scared. But I think that there is still upside here that he is going to kind of get rewarded for.
For me, he just doesn't play enough baseball games. That freaking simple. At number 19, Ha-Sung Kim. Weird year for him. He's a great infield defender. Not a lot of pop. I also don't know. This would be my other don't know what to make of him guy. What are your thoughts on Kim?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that what he's proven, the interesting thing about his offense is that his plate discipline just gets better and better and better. His strikeout rate was a career low. His walk rate was a career high.
as we sort of expected when he first came over, I know he had 17 home runs in 2023. The power is just limited. He just doesn't hit the ball very hard. And I just am not convinced he's going to be ever slugging in a real way. But if you're one of the best infield defenders in the world, which he is, and you're playing shortstop all the time, it doesn't really matter that much if you can still reach base at a reasonable clip. So I don't know. I agree that maybe we're underselling him, because if he is a 17 homer a year guy, then he should be higher on this list. I think when we talked about him last year, we were like, oh my God, he's going to get super paid. You know, he finishes the year with shoulder surgery and the power is back down and you're kind of a little bit less into it. So we could end up really underselling him here. But I think there's still some concerns, just the offensive potential.
Three starting pitchers next. Let's group them together. 18, Nick Martinez, 17, Nathan Eovaldi, and 16, Yusei Kikuchi. Jordan, let's just pick one of these three to focus on.
I like all of them, to be honest, for very different reasons. The fact that Eovaldi just threw 170 innings and nobody really noticed is pretty amazing. I think Martinez is very underrated. The fact that he got the qualifying offer similar to Pivetta, I think, says a lot about him. And then Kikuchi. I could see someone falling super in love with Kikuchi and thinking that there's still upside with him, especially because he is a lefty, you know, that throws 96. And there's not that many of those that can strike out the number of guys that he can. So I agree. I'm happy with the order we have them in, but I could see them all getting very different contracts.
At number 15, Gleyber Torres.
This is easy. This is signing last for me. This guy, ooh. No one is going to touch him for a long time. I think, especially at second base, teams are going to rather just try to get creative as long as possible before jumping at Gleyber Torres because of all the questions. I still kind of like him. I know
he's a
that anyone,
fascinating. Fascinating.
He's
free
still
agent.
One of the youngest free agents. I still think that the offensive that he can give you, even as like an average version of him, is still pretty good. I understand all the concerns. I understand people that just don't think he's a winning player. I think he could end up being great value. I think he could end up being just as disappointing as everybody expects. But for all those things, I think he will be signing very, very, very late.
The one thing I can guarantee you, he is not coming back to the Bronx. At number 14, Jurickson Profar. Another guy I don't know what to do with.
Yeah.
Like, he's just a mediocre Major League Baseball player for like 10, 11 years, and then just shows up back in San Diego this year, and his numbers are unfreaking believable. Maybe the best season ever offensively for a player his age to not get a qualifying offer. I mean, he started the All-Star game in the outfield. He's going to finish in the top 10 in the National League MVP. And yet, no thanks.
Right. He has to be one of the just most bizarre, because we've known this guy forever, and then for him to finally do it, we want to be like, yes, that's what we've been waiting for. And then we're like, nah, I don't buy it. Especially if it's not in San Diego. I would be pretty scared if someone else gives him, you know, $70 million. I'm not feeling super awesome about that. But it might happen, because my gosh, was he good.
Our next group, three more starting pitchers. At number 13, Sean Manaea. At number 12, Luis Severino. At number 11, Jack Flaherty. Severino and Manaea both getting the qualifying offer. Flaherty, because he was traded during the season, was ineligible to receive it for the second consecutive year. Pick one of these three for me.
I'm all in on Severino. I was super in on him last year. He's the one, just because I think that him showing that he could be healthy, that he could be a different kind of pitcher, that he adapted his pitch mix, that he, you know, showed some promising signs in the postseason again. I just like everything that Luis Severino is about. I understand that Manaea was better after he made his adjustments, and I understand that Flaherty, you know, the full season of work was in some ways more impressive. But I've always been a big Severino guy, and he's the one that I like here.
I'm Manaea over Severino for the following reason. Severino's swing and miss rate, his whiff rate, was relatively low considering how hard he throws. And I think that if that velo continues to go down, he's going to have a bit of a problem getting strikeouts. Whereas for Manaea, he just discovered this new wonky arm angle, and I think that there's a little bit more unscratched potential there that a team can capitalize on. And if the fastball velocity goes down for Manaea, like, it's already down. You know what I mean? So I have less of a worry there. Flaherty, I also don't know what to make of. Like, again, you watch the World Series. Game 1, unreal. Game 5, Totally butt. And so I think the real Jack Flaherty is somewhere in between there. Fascinated to see what team takes a chance on him. Okay, let's wade into the top 10. And let's group second tier bats together. At 10, Anthony Santander. At 9, Christian Walker. At 8, Teoscar Hernandez. And at 7, Pete Alonso.
Ooh, second tier Pete.
Second tier Pete.
Yeah.
Let's spend a second on Teoscar.
So Teoscar Hernandez, again, basically as good of a one-year situation as you can have. It was really a reestablishing of the player that we clearly thought he was in Toronto, but doing it for the best team in baseball, doing it for a whole season, doing it in the postseason, and just it all came together. And again, like his, you know, the risks of him, he's still striking out a good amount, but his track record of like, he's kind of mastered that balance of like, yes, this is who he is, but it's not like you're going to say like, oh, it's suddenly going to fall off. I mean, I guess you could say that if the bat speed goes, but I don't know. I still think that this is someone that, as we just saw, the resume here of I was one of the most important players, arguably the second most important hitter over the course of the full season for the Dodgers. You know, of course, at the end, we know it was Freddie, we know it was Mookie. But after Shohei, he was the most consistent guy for the entirety of the year. I just think he's really good, and I think he clearly wants to be in LA, and how that plays out, how badly they want him back compared to how badly he wants to stay there is going to be really interesting, because as with some of these other guys who maybe want to stay, like Profar, like whatever, some other team might be like, here's $80 million. I don't think the Dodgers are going to give him that much, but we will see. Maybe I'm wrong.
Quick word on Pete Alonso. Why is he here? Why is he not higher? The arrow is pointing in the wrong direction. He has been a good hitter now, not a great one, for the last two seasons. When he got Scott Boras as his agent, it was clear that he was looking to be paid like an elite player. I don't think Pete is an elite player. If he had this offensive production and was an average center field defender, he'd be four spots higher. Who's a better hitter, Pete Alonso or Willy Adames? Probably Pete Alonso. In my opinion, if I had to pick one of those two for offensive production moving forward, there are a lot of home runs left in this bat. But for me, the reason why Pete is here is that he is a first baseman with relatively low athleticism, who's not a great defender, who hits from the right side, who's about to turn 30. It is a trapdoor profile. I think Pete is a great player. I would want him around my team. It's just about where the price is going to be for him. And I think he ends up returning to the Mets. I think he means more for that franchise, and that franchise could use what he provides. That being said, I don't want to say Pete scares me, because I still think he has many productive seasons left, but there's a reason that a player this well-known is not higher on the list. We have a handful more at number 6 and at number 5, a couple of left-handed pitchers. Max Fried and Blake Snell.
These are two also that will be very interesting to compare, because in some respects you can say that they are very similar. Obviously, the highs for Snell have been much higher, but the body of work on the whole is not all that dissimilar, I would say. And I think that Max Fried feels more durable, but then you look in and you're like, oh, you got some forearm issues. That's not super awesome. I don't love that. Whereas Snell, it's been more lengthier absences, and he's had more than just arm issues. I know you're all in on Snell. I still feel like Fried is I'd feel a little more comfortable giving Fried a lot of money, just because some of the secondary skills, the strike throwing, you know, getting the ground balls, feels like it'll age better. But I love Snell too, and I would be excited to have either of these guys on my team.
I would give Snell the Trevor Bauer style contract, where it's just a ton of money on a really short term. Whereas Fried, I'd give
a more
him
extreme version of last year. What he got last year,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, for Fried, I'd give him more years with a lower AAV. Snell can start game one of a playoff series for me any freaking day of the week. When he is healthy, he is a difference maker. But at the same time, he won the Cy Young last year, and 30 baseball teams were like, "Nah, That is an unavoidable fact. The reasons why they didn't feel comfortable giving him a bucket of money, the walks, the lack of durability, I understand that. I just disagree with 30 baseball teams. That's where I'm coming from. Now, did he have a weird 2024? Yes. But by the end of the season, he was cooking. And if you're a contender, that's all that matters. If, like, think about it this way. If any of the playoff teams had given Blake Snell the contract the Giants gave him, that's a huge deal. Huge deal.
Oh, huge, totally.
Like, potentially changes the complexion of a series.
And so they traded for him. Remember? I mean, we were talking about him as a trade candidate. You know, like, that was, in theory, still in play as well.
I was going to save my dude I'm high on for Willy Adames, but I'm going to use it now on Blake Snell. I'm going to spend that bullet now. I am all in on Blake Snell. I can't wait to be proven wrong. I just think, like, he's on my list of 10 pitchers I'd want starting one game.
I don't disagree, but man, like, what a turn. If you listened to this show for a while, this is not how Jake felt about Blake Snell not all that long ago. So I'm pretty amazed that he has turned this far in the positive direction for him. But I'm not saying I disagree with it, but that was not what you've always been saying about him. It's kind of wild.
I still don't like watching him pitch.
You just know he's good. Yeah.
I just know he's good. Yeah. Simple as that.
Yeah. All right. We have four more players, and we're going to do this quickly because the reality is these are the guys we're going to be talking about the most for the rest of the winter. So you have Willy Adames and Alex Bregman are our next two infielders. Basically, what they have going for them is that, yes, I know Ha-Sung Kim is, you could argue, but like, they are so far and away the best options at their positions, especially Bregman at third, that they are going to have that leverage for as long as they want it, in a way that these outfielders can just be like, oh, but you know, you could, or even the first baseman could just be like, oh, but we have all these other alternatives. Whereas Willy at short and Bregman at third, they can just be like, listen, we're the best you can get right now. And so that's what that is. And you should pay us accordingly. Willy does not have to worry about competing with five other awesome shortstops the way Dansby Swanson did a few years ago. And Willy has a very similar, you know, resume leading up to his free agency the way that Swanson did. Anything else on those two? Before we just get to the top?
Nope.
Okay. Corbin Burnes and Juan Soto.
Good. Both good.
I just, honestly, the thing with Burnes is like, is he that much better than Snell and Fried? In the way that he's trending, you know, you could say no, but it's just such a longer, you know, and not that Fried doesn't have a long track record, but Burnes just has the feel of the guy at the top of the class in a way that doesn't have any of the questions. And by the way that he finished his season is a nice way to be like, oh yeah, Corbin Burnes is still him. And he is the one pitcher in this class that I feel like is going to get $200 million, or at least has the best chance of doing it. Is it a guarantee? I feel pretty good that he will end up with $200 million, which is not a small thing for a pitcher, obviously. And I think that will be reflected. And then Juan Soto's going to get triple that, which is so much money and totally deserved.
I don't even want to talk about Soto. He's number one on the list.
Well, we're going to be doing whole podcasts about him. So,
bingo. Let's kick that down the road. That's our list. That's our top 50. You can go digest that in written form over at Yahoo. Jordan Schusterman, any other major things we need to talk about? We didn't even mention Jorge Soler yet.
No.
He's on the Angels now. They need any kind of upside player that didn't fit the Braves roster. I'm going to turbo mode a couple of these real quick. Michael Wacha signs a deal with the Royals, 3 years, $51 million. He was going to be a free agent. He had an opt-out. Makes sense. Good for both sides. Royals keep spending money. That's awesome. Michael Wacha seems comfortable there. That's great. He's a valuable number three starter. He's totally fine. Less valuable in the postseason when you really only want him throwing, you know, four innings.
The only other big move I just wanted to mention, and again, we're going to cover some of this other news in terms of hirings, I think later this week, is Cody Bellinger. This is the last move I want to talk about before we say goodbye today. Cody Bellinger opting into $27.5 million was a very interesting decision, not just because he was saying that I don't think that I can do better than that or close to better than that in the open market. I think it speaks to his free agency experience. I think it speaks to where the season that he just had, which is basically just a watered down version of his weird rejuvenation, reinvention of himself in his first year with the Cubs. But I also think that it puts the Cubs in a fascinating situation because right now, Cody Bellinger's ultimately super valuable skill of I can play center field and I can play first base. The Cubs don't need a first baseman or a center fielder right now. And so where that leaves Cody Bellinger on this roster and how they navigate around having him, I know Jed Hoyer comes out and says, oh, when a good player decides to stay with you, that's a good thing. Sure. Like, okay, that's sort of true, but his fit on the roster is very, very, very strange. And I think the Cubs are a team we're going to be having a lot of interesting conversations about this winter.
Is Cody Bellinger opting in a Scott Boris win?
I think...
Or is it a draw?
I think it's a draw because he put him in position to still make $27.5 million this year after we weren't sure how good he even was. So in that sense, it's a win. But people also thought he should have signed for even more last year. So maybe that's still a reflective loss. So I don't know. But he had the option and he chose it. So I think in that way, it's hard to call that a loss.
I think it's a draw. Scott Boris moves to 0-1-1 this year. That's a hard-fought victory on the road.
Yes, indeed. More news to be covered later this week on Friday. Thank you all for listening on a strange day for us here as we talk into these microphones. Just for us. Yeah, definitely just us. But we appreciate everyone who listens. Again, if you have bigger picture thoughts about how we're all feeling, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com or thoughts about free agency, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. We appreciate the support and we appreciate you listening. And we hope that if you did choose to listen to this, we hope, which we understand if you didn't, we hope you enjoyed it. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz. And thank you, Jake Mintz, for podcasting with me as always. We will talk to you on Friday. Bye, friends.
Goodbye.